flushed the john, these black blind frogs came jumping out. An interesting image. Marianne went home to get medical help for her child, Nicholas, who had been sick on a boat and confined to his cabin for most of the journey. So Mick and Anita and I worked our way to Lima, Peru, and then up to Cusco, which is 11,000 feet. Everybody's been a bit short of breath, and we get to the hotel lobby, and it's lined wall to wall with these huge oxygen tanks. We get to our rooms, and in the middle of the night, Anita finds that the john's not working. So she takes a pee in the sink, and in the middle of the pee, the sink collapses to the floor, and water comes shooting out of a huge pipe. Real Marx Brothers, slapdash, carry on. Stuff some rags down there, call the people. The sink was shattered, lying in pieces. But the weird thing is that when they finally arrived in the middle of the night, the Peruvians were very nice. They didn't go, "What are you doing? How did you break the sink?" They just mopped it up and gave us another room. I thought they were going to bring the cops with them. Next day, Mick and I went for a walk, sat on a bench, and did what you do in the daytime. Started chewing coca leaves. When we got back to the hotel, we found a card delivered, as if from the British consul. "General so-and-so, it would be fortuitous to meet." The general in question was the military governor of Machu Picchu, who invited us to his home for dinner. And you can't very well say no to that. He did run the area, and he gave out the permissions and travel passes. Obviously, he's very bored in this province, so he summoned us to his villa outside of Cusco. He was living with a German DJ, a blonde boy. I'll never forget the decor. It had all been ordered from Mexico or straight from the States. He was one of those guys that kept the furniture wrapped in plastic covers. Probably because the insects would eat everything the minute you unwrapped it. Oh, terrible furniture. But the actual villa was very nice. Like an old Spanish mission, as far as I can remember. The general was charming and a great host, and we had good food. And then came the pièce de résistance, performed by his boyfriend, the German DJ. They put on these terrible twist records. Phony soul, and this was 1969. And then he orders this poor boy to demonstrate how to do the swim, a dance already so old I could barely remember it. He lay on the floor and started rolling around doing the breaststroke. Mick and I looked at each other. "Where the fuck? How do we get out of here?" It was almost impossible to not burst out laughing, because the guy's doing his best. He thinks he's doing the best swim south of the border. "Yeah, get down, man." And he would do anything the general ordered him to do. "Now do the mashed potato," and he would instantly obey. We really thought we'd gone back 100 years or so. We travelled to Urubamba, a village not far from Machu Picchu, on a river of the same name. Once you got out there, you were out there, man. There was nothing there. No hotel, certainly. This place was not on the tourist map. The only white people they ever saw were lost. In fact, we were basically lost. But eventually, we found this bar and had a nice meal, shrimps and rice and beans. And we said, "Well, we've only got this car. Any chance of some dormir?" And at first, a lot of no's went round the room. But they noticed we had a guitar with us. So Mick and I serenaded them for about an hour, trying to come up with any old thing we could think of. It seemed to me you needed a majority vote to get invited to sleep on the premises. And Anita being pregnant, I did want to give her a bed for the night. We must have done all right. I did a few bits of Malagueña, and a few other songs that sounded vaguely Spanish that Gus had taught me. And finally, the landlord said we could have a couple of rooms upstairs. The only time Mick and I sang for a bed. It was a good writing period. Songs were coming. Honky Tonk Women, which came out as a single before the next album, Let It Bleed, in July 1969, was the culmination of everything we were good at the time. It's a funky track, and dirty too. It's the first major use of the open tuning where the riff and the rhythm guitar provide the melody. It's got all that blues and black music from Dartford onwards in it, and Charlie is unbelievable on that track. It was a groove, no doubt about it, and it's one of those tracks that you knew was a number one before you'd finished the motherfucker. In those days, I used to set up the riffs and the titles and the hook, and Mick would fill it in. That was basically the gig. We didn't really think too much or agonize. There you go. This one goes like this. I met a fucking bitch in somewhere city. Take it away, Mick. Your job now. I've given you the riff, baby. You fill it in, and meanwhile I'll try and come up with another one. And he can write, can Mick. Give him the idea, and he'll run with it. We also composed using what we called vowel movement. Very important for songwriters. The sounds that work. Many times you don't know what the word is, but you know the word has got to contain this vowel, this sound. You can write something that'll look really good on paper, but it doesn't contain the right sound. You start to build the consonants around the vowels. There's a place to go ooh, and there's a place to go da. And if you get it wrong, it sounds like crap. It's not necessarily that it rhymes with anything at the moment, and you've got to look for that rhyming word too, but you know there's a particular vowel involved. Doo-wop is not called that for nothing. That was all vowel movement. Gimme Shelter and You Got the Silver were the first tracks we recorded in Olympic Studios for what became Let It Bleed, the album that we worked on throughout the summer of 69, the summer that Brian died. You Got the Silver was not the first solo vocal I recorded with the Stones. That was Connection. But it was one of the first ones I wrote entirely by myself and laid on Mick. And I sang it solo simply because we had to spread the workload. We'd always sung harmony, like the Everlys. So it wasn't as if I'd suddenly started to sing. But like all my songs, it never felt like my creation. I'm a damn good antenna to pick up songs zooming through the room, but that's all. Where did Midnight Rambler come from? I don't know. It was the old days, trying to knock you on the back of the head. Hey, don't forget us, pal. Write a damn good blues. Write one that takes the form in another way, just for a bit. Midnight Rambler is a Chicago blues. The chord sequence isn't, but the sound is pure Chicago. I knew how the rhythm should go. It was in the tightness of the chord sequence, the D's and the A's and the E's. It wasn't a blues sequence, but it came out like heavy-duty blues. That's one of the most original blues you'll hear from the Stones. The title, the subject, was just one of those phrases taken out of sensationalist headlines that only exist for a day. You just happen to be looking at a newspaper. Midnight Rambler on the loose again. Ooh, I'll have him. The fact that you could get that kind of tasty bite into the lyrics, by mixing in contemporary stories or headlines or just what appeared to be mundane daily narrative was so far away from pop music and also from Cole Porter or Hoagy Carmichael. I saw her today at the reception. It was just very plain. No dynamics, no sense of where it was going. I think Mick and I looked at each other and said, well, if John and Paul can do it. The Beatles and Bob Dylan, to a great extent, changed songwriting in that way, and people's attitudes towards voice. Bob has not got a particularly great voice, but it's expressive, and he knows where to put it. And that's more important than any technical beauties of voice. It's almost anti-singing, but at the same time, what you're hearing is real. You can't always get what you want, was basically all Mick. I remember him coming into the studio and saying, I've got this song. I said, you got any verses? And he said, I have, but how's it going to sound? Because he'd written it on guitar, it was like a folk song at the time. I had to come up with a rhythm, an idea. I'd float it around the band and just play the sequence here and there. And maybe Charlie decides which to go for. It's all experimentation. And then we added the choir on the end, very deliberately. Let's put on a straight chorus. In other words, let's try and reach them people up there as well. It was a dare, kind of. Mick and I thought it should go into a choir, a gospel thing, because we'd play with black gospel singers in America. And then, what if we got one of the best choirs in England, all these white, lovely singers, and do it that way, see what we can get out of them. Turn them on a little bit. Get him into a little sway and a move, you know. You can't always. Oh, it was a beautiful juxtaposition. In early June, when we were working every day in Olympic Studios on these tracks, I turned over the Mercedes with Anita in it when she was 7 months pregnant with Marlon. Anita broke her collarbone. I took her to St. Richard's and they patched her up within half an hour while I sat around. Really brilliant people looking after us. Only to walk out straight into the arms of the Brighton CID, who then took us to Chichester Police Station and started to interrogate us. I've got a pregnant woman with a broken collarbone, for Christ's sake. It's 3 in the morning and they don't give a shit. The more I deal with cops, especially British cops, I must say, something's wrong with the training. My attitude probably didn't help. But what am I going to do? Roll over for them? Get out of here. They suspected drugs. Of course there were drugs involved. They should have looked in the oak tree round the corner. They start with, how did the car turn over? You must have been out of it. Actually, no. On a corner, close to Redlands, a red light came on in the car and nothing would work. A hydraulic fault. Brakes wouldn't work, steering wouldn't work. It just teetered on a patch of slippery grass and then rolled over. It was a convertible and it was 3 tons rolling on the windscreen on the struts that hold up the canvas. The miracle was that the windscreen held up. I only found out later it was because the car was built in 1947 out of Panzer parts and armored steel, immediately post-war German scrap lying around the battlefield, whatever they could get their hands on. This shit was heavy-duty steel. Basically, I was riding a tank with a canvas roof. No wonder they swept through France in 6 weeks. No wonder they almost took Russia. The Panzers saved my life. My body left the car. I watched it all happen from 12, 15 feet above. You can leave your body, believe me. I've been trying all my life. But this was the first real experience of it. I watched that thing roll over in slow motion 3 times. Very dispassionate, very cool about it. I was an observer. No emotion involved. You're already dead. Forget about it. But meanwhile, before the lights actually went out, I noticed the underside of the car, and I noticed it was built with these diagonal riveted struts underneath. Very solid-looking things. It all appeared to be slow motion. You're holding a very long breath. And I know that Anita is in the car, and I'm wondering, in another part of my mind, if Anita is also watching from above. I'm more concerned about her than I am myself, because I'm not even in the car. I've escaped in the mind, or whatever you think you are when things like that happen in a split second. But then it came pounding, rubber side down, after 3 turns into this hedge, and suddenly I'm back behind the wheel. So Marlon had his first car crash 2 months before he was born. No wonder he has never driven, never obtained a driving license. Marlon's full name is Marlon Leon Sandeep. Brando called up while Anita was in hospital to compliment her on performance. Marlon, that's a good name. Why don't we call him Marlon? The poor kid was forced through this religious ceremony when he arrived home in Cheyne Walk. The rice and the flower petals and the chanting and all that shit. Anita's the mother, right? Who am I to say no? Anything you like, mother. You've just given birth to our son. So the bowls of Bengal came, courtesy of Robert Fraser. And Robert had a crib made, beautiful little one, that rocked. So that's his full name, Marlon Leon Sandeep Richards, which is the most important bit. The rest is mere pretext. It's strange, given the fact that we'd had to pull the plug on Brian in the studio 3 years earlier, when he was lying in a coma beside his buzzing amp, to be reminded that he was still playing on tracks early in 1969, the year of his death. Auto harp on You Got the Silver, percussion on Midnight Rambler. Where did that come from? A last flare from the shipwreck. By May, we were playing in his replacement, Mick Taylor, at Olympic Studios, playing him in on Honky Tonk Women, on which his overdub is there for posterity. No surprise to us how good he was. He seemed just to step in naturally at the time. We had all heard Mick, and we knew him because he played with John Mayall and the Blues Breakers. Everybody was looking at me because I was the other guitar player. But my position was, I'd play with anybody. We could only find out by playing together. And we did the most brilliant stuff together, some of the most brilliant stuff the Stones ever did. Everything was there in his playing, the melodic touch, a beautiful sustain, and a way of reading a song. He had a lovely sound, some very soulful stuff. He'd get where I was going even before I did. I was in awe sometimes listening to Mick Taylor, especially on that slide. Try it on Love in Vain. Sometimes just jamming, warming up with him, I'd go, whoa. I guess that's where the emotion came out. I loved the guy. I loved to work with him. But he was very shy and very distant. I'd get close to him when we were working out stuff and playing. And when he let his hair down, he was extremely funny. But I always found it very difficult to find any more than the Mick Taylor I'd met the first time. You can see it on the screen in Gimme Shelter. His face has no animation. He was fighting himself somewhere inside. There's not a lot you can do about that with guys like that. You can't bring them out. They've got to fight their own demons. You bring them out for an hour or two, for an evening or a night. But the next day, he was brooding again. Not a barrel of laughs, let's put it like that. Well, you give certain people their space. You realize, some guys you can spend a day with them, and basically you've learned all you're ever going to know about them. Like Mick Jagger, an exact reverse. We'd already fired Brian 2 or 3 weeks before he died. It had come to a head, and Mick and I had been down at Winnie the Pooh's house. Cotchford Farm had belonged to author A.A. Milne, and Brian had recently bought it. Mick and I didn't fancy the gig, but we drove down together and said, "Hey, Brian, it's all over, pal." We were in the studio when we got the phone call not long afterwards, cutting with Mick Taylor. There exists 1 minute and 30 seconds of us recording I Don't Know Why, a Stevie Wonder song, interrupted by the phone call telling us of Brian's death. I knew Frank Thorogood, who made a deathbed confession that he'd killed Brian Jones by drowning him in the swimming pool where Brian's body was found some minutes after other people had seen him alive, but always wary of deathbed confessions, because the only person there is the person he's supposed to have said it to, some uncle, daughter, or wherever. On his deathbed, he said he killed Brian. Whether he did or not, I don't know. Brian had bad asthma, and he was taking Quaaludes and Tylenols, which are not the best things to dive underwater on. Very easy to choke on that stuff. He was heavily sedated. He had a high tolerance for drugs, I'll give him that. But weigh that against the coroner's report, which showed that he was suffering from pleurisy, an enlarged heart and a diseased liver. Still, I can imagine the scenario of Brian being so obnoxious to Thorogood and the building crew he had working on Brian's house, that they were just pissing around with him. He went under and didn't come up. But when somebody says, "I did Brian," at the very most I'd put it down to manslaughter. All right, you may have pushed him under, but you weren't there to murder him. He pissed off the builders, whining son of a bitch. It wouldn't have mattered if the builders were there or not. He was at that point in his life when there wasn't any. 3 days later, July 5th, we performed our first concert in over 2 years in Hyde Park. A free concert to which something like 500,000 people came, and it was an amazing show. The all-important thing for us was our first appearance for a long time, and with a change of personnel. It was Mick Taylor's first gig. We were going to do it anyway. Obviously, a statement had to be made of one kind or another, so we turned it into a memorial for Brian. We wanted to see him off in grand style. The ups and downs with the guy are one thing, but when his time's over, release the doves, or in this case, the sackfuls of white butterflies. We went touring in the USA in November 69 with Mick Taylor. B.B. King and Ike and Tina Turner were opening acts, which was a hot show just by itself. Added to that, it was the first tour that the open tuning riffs, the big new sound, were let loose on audiences. The most powerful effect was on Ike Turner. The open tuning fascinated him the way it had fascinated me. He dragged me into his dressing room, basically at gunpoint, I believe in San Diego. "Show me that 5-string shit." We were there for about 45 minutes, and I showed him the basics of it. And the next thing was Come Together, that beautiful album that Ike and Tina did, and all of it was 5-string. He got the hang of it in 45 minutes, picked it up like that. But to me, the amazing thing is, I'm showing Ike Turner shit? With musicians, there's this weird crossing over between awe and respect and being accepted. When other guys come to you and go, hey man, show me that lick, and they're guys that you've been listening to for years, that's when you know that you're amongst men now. Okay, I can't believe it, but I'm part of the front line, top hands. And the other great thing about musicians, or most of them, is the reciprocation, the generosity they show to one another. Have you got that little pop? Yeah, it goes like this. Mostly, there are no secrets. Everybody swaps ideas. How did you get that? And he shows you, and you realize it's really simple. Oiled up and running hot. In early December, we ended up at Muscle Shoals Sound Studios in Sheffield, Alabama, at tour's end, or not quite end, since the Altamont Speedway track loomed in the distance some days away. There we cut Wild Horses, Brown Sugar, and You Gotta Move. 3 tracks in 3 days in that perfect 8-track recording studio. Muscle Shoals was a great room to work, very unpretentious. You could go in there and do a take, none of this fiddling about. Oh, can we try the bass over there? You just went in, hit it, and there it was. It was the creme de la creme. Except it was just a shack in the middle of nowhere. The people that put the studio together, great bunch of Southern guys, Roger Hawkins and Jimmy Johnson and a couple of others owned it, were famed musicians, part of the Muscle Shoals rhythm section, who had been in the house band at Rick Hall's Fame Studios, previously situated in Muscle Shoals proper. That setup already had a legendary ring, because some great soul records have been coming out of there for several years. Wilson Pickett, Aretha Franklin, Percy Sledge's When a Man Loves a Woman. So to us, it was on a par with going to Chess Records, even though it was out the way and we had wanted to record in Memphis. But you should hear the late Jim Dickinson, piano player on Wild Horses, tell what happened. He was a Southern boy and a good storyteller. This is the part of the story nobody knows, because even in Stanley Booth's book, he, for whatever reason, chose not to tell it. But the way they got to Muscle Shoals was Stanley. He was traveling with them for the biography, and he called me in the middle of the night. My wife and I had met him down in Auburn and seen the show, thinking that would be it. And he calls maybe a week, week and a half later and says, is there anywhere in Memphis the Stones could record? They've got 3 days at the end of their tour and they've been on the road playing together and they're hot. They've got some new material. Now, at the time, from the American Federation of Musicians, you could get a touring permit or a recording permit as a foreign band, but you couldn't get both. And they have been barred from recording in Los Angeles. The way I heard it, Leon Russell tried to set up a session for them in L.A. and was fined by the musicians' union. Anyway, they were looking for a place that would be under the union radar, and they thought about Memphis. Well, the Beatles had tried to record in Memphis at Stax and had been refused for insurance reasons or for whatever reason, and there really wasn't any place in Memphis that they could have safely recorded anonymously. And I told Stanley that, and it made Stanley mad. He said, "Well, what the hell am I supposed to tell him?" I said, "Tell him to go to Muscle Shoals. Nobody will even know who they are," which in fact, nobody did. And Stanley responded negatively. He said, "Well, I don't know any of those rednecks down there. How am I supposed to?" I said, "Call Jerry Wexler. He'll set it up." But what I didn't know, what nobody knew at that point, was that the Stones' contract with EMI was run down. Well, you can bet Wexler knew it. He put it together in a heartbeat. And I didn't hear any more about it for another week or 10 days. And then Stanley calls in the middle of the night. He says, "Be in Muscle Shoals on Thursday. The Stones are going to record." And he says, "Don't tell anybody." So I didn't use my car. I took my wife's car so nobody would recognize it. I drove down there, and the old studio was across the highway from the cemetery. The old studio had actually been a coffin factory. It was a real small building. So I go to the door, and Jimmy Johnson opens the door just a crack, and he looks at me and says, "Dickinson, what do you want?" And I said, "I've come down for the Stone session." And he says, "Oh, hell, does everyone in Memphis know?" I said, "No, nobody knows, Jimmy. It's cool, don't worry." And nobody was there at this point. They hadn't showed up yet. When they showed up, it was the biggest plane that ever landed in the Muscle Shoals airport. Because I was with Stanley, I got to stay. Oh, you'll hear different people claim they were there. There was no one there. I've been asked several times if Gram Parsons was there. Well, hell, if Gram Parsons had been there, I certainly would never have played the piano. It would have been him. So there was literally no one from the outside there. And Keith and I hit it off right away. And waiting for Jagger and whoever else, we started jamming. They still, to this day, think I'm a country piano player. I'm not sure why, because I can barely play country music. I had a couple of licks from Floyd Kramer's stuff, but I think it was because of Gram Parsons. They had just got to be buddies with Gram, and I think Keith was kind of fascinated by country music. So we sat around that afternoon, playing Hank Williams songs and Jerry Lee Lewis songs, and they let me stay. And as Mick was singing Brown Sugar, the pickup line into the refrain was different in every verse. I was in the control room with Stanley, and I said, "Stanley, he's leaving out a great line." And right then, I heard this voice come from behind the console where there was a couch. Charlie Watts was sitting there, and I hadn't even seen him in the room, or I wouldn't have said it. And Charlie says, "Tell him." And I said, "I'm not going to tell him." And Charlie reaches over to the console, punches the talkback button, and he says, "Tell him." So I said, "Okay. Mick, you're leaving a line out. You were singing, 'Hear him whip the women just around midnight,' in the first verse, which is a great line." And Jagger kind of halfway laughed and said, "Oh, yeah? Who said that? Is that Booth?" And Charlie Watts said, "No, it's Dickinson." And Jagger said, "Same thing." I'm not sure what he meant by that. I guess just another wise-ass Southern guy. So, if I have a footnote to rock and roll history, that's it. Because, by God, "Hear 'em whip the women" is in there because of me. Dickinson was a beautiful piano player. Probably at the time, I did take him for a country player, just because he was a Southern guy. I found out later he was far more wide-ranging. Playing with guys like that was a break, because you got stuck in this star thing. And there were all these musicians you'd heard about and wanted to play with, but you never got the chance to. So working with Dickinson and just getting the feel, really, of the South and the way we were automatically accepted down South was wonderful. They'd say, "You're from London? How the hell do you play like that?" Jim Dickinson, who was the only other musician there apart from the Rolling Stones and Ian Stewart, was perplexed. When on the third day we started running through Wild Horses, and Ian Stewart took a back seat. Wild Horses started in a B minor chord, and Stu didn't play minor chords, fucking Chinese music. That's how Dickinson got the gig of playing on the track. Wild Horses almost wrote itself. It was really a lot to do with, once again, fucking around with the tunings. I found these chords, especially doing it on a 12-string to start with, which gave the song this character and sound. There's a certain forlornness that can come out of a 12-string. I started off, I think, on a regular 6-string open E, and it sounded very nice. Sometimes you just get these ideas. What if I open-tuned a 12-string? All it meant was translate what blind Willie McTell was doing, 12-string slide, into 5-string mode, which meant a 10-string guitar. I now have a couple custom-built for that. It was one of those magical moments when things come together. It's like satisfaction. You just dream it, and suddenly it's all in your hands. Once you've got the vision in your mind of Wild Horses, I mean, what's the next phrase you're going to use? It's got to be, "Couldn't drag me away." That's one of the great things about songwriting. It's not an intellectual experience. One might have to apply the brain here and there, but basically, it's capturing moments. Jim Dickinson, bless him. He died August 15th, 2009, while I was writing this book. We'll say later on what Wild Horses was about. I'm not sure. I never thought about songwriting as writing a diary. Although sometimes, in retrospect, you realize that some of it is like that. What is it that makes you want to write songs? In a way, you want to stretch yourself into other people's hearts. You want to plant yourself there, or at least get a resonance, where other people become a bigger instrument than the one you're playing. It becomes almost an obsession to touch other people. To write a song that is remembered and taken to heart is a connection, a touching of bases, a thread that runs through all of us, a stab to the heart. Sometimes I think songwriting is about tightening the heartstrings as much as possible without bringing on a heart attack. Dickinson reminded me of the speed with which we did things in those days. We were well rehearsed from being on the road. Nevertheless, he remembered that both Brown Sugar and Wild Horses were done in 2 takes. Unheard of later, when I would comb through 40 or 50 versions of a song looking for the spark. The thing about 8-track was it was punch in and go. And it was a perfect format for the Stones. You walk into that studio and you know where the drums are going to be and what they sound like. Soon after that, there were 16 and then 24 tracks. And everyone was scrambling around these huge desks. It made it much more difficult to make records. The canvas becomes enormous, and it becomes much harder to focus. 8-track is my preferable means of recording a 4-, 5-, 6-piece band. Here's one last observation from Jim on that, in some ways, historic recording session, since we're still playing those same songs. They started running down Brown Sugar the first night, but they didn't get a take. I watched Mick write the lyrics. It took him maybe 45 minutes. It was disgusting. He wrote it down as fast as he could move his hand. I'd never seen anything like it. He had one of those yellow legal pads, and he'd write a verse a page. Just write a verse, and then turn the page. And when he had 3 pages filled, they started to cut it. It was amazing. If you listen to the lyrics, he says, "Sky Dog Slaver," though it's always written, "Scarred Old Slaver." What does that mean? Sky Dog is what they call Dwayne Allman in Muscle Shoals, because he was high all the time. And Jagger heard somebody say it, and he thought it was a cool word, so he used it. He was writing about literally being in the South. It was amazing to watch him do it. The same thing happened with Wild Horses. Keith had Wild Horses written as a lullaby. It was about Marlon, about not wanting to leave home because he just had a son. And Jagger rewrote it, and it's perceptibly about Marianne Faithfull. And Jagger was like a high school kid about it, and he wrote the song about her. He took a little more time with it, but not much more, maybe an hour. The way he did it, Keith had some words, and then he grunted and he groaned. And somebody asked Mick, "Do you understand that?" And Jagger looked at him and said, "Of course." It was like he was translating, you know? They were unbelievable, the raw vocals. They both stood at the microphone together with a fifth of bourbon, passing it back and forth, and sang the lead and the harmony into one microphone on all 3 songs. Pretty much as quick as they could do it on the last night. And so we went from Muscle Shoals to the Altamont Speedway, from the sublime to the ridiculous. Altamont was strange, particularly because we were pretty laid back after touring and cutting tracks. "Sure, we'll do a free concert, why not? Thank you very much, everybody." And then the Grateful Dead got involved. We invited them in because they were the ones that did this all the time. We just hooked into their pipeline and said, "Do you think we could put one together in the next 2 or 3 weeks? Thing is that Altamont wouldn't have been Altamont at all if it wasn't for the absolute stupidity of the bone-headed, hard-nosed San Francisco Council. We were going to put it on in their version of Central Park. They'd put the stage up, and then they'd withdrawn the license, the permits, and they'd torn it down. And then it was, "Oh, you can have this joint." And we were in Alabama somewhere, cutting records. So we said, "We'll leave it to you guys, and we'll turn up and play." So it ended up that the only place left was this speedway track in Altamont, which is way, way beyond the boondocks. No security whatsoever, except for the Hell's Angels, if you can call that secure. But it was 69, and there was a lot of rampant anarchy. Policemen were very thin on the ground. I think I saw 3 cops for 500,000 people. I've no doubt there were a few more, but their presence was minimal. Basically, it was one huge commune that sprang out the ground for 2 days. It was very medieval in look and feel. Guys with bells on, chanting, "Hashish! Peyote!" You can see it all in Gimme Shelter. a culmination of hippie commune and what can happen when it goes wrong. I was amazed that things didn't go more wrong than they did. Meredith Hunter was murdered. Three others died accidentally. With a show that size, sometimes the body count is four or five people trampled or suffocated. Look at The Who, playing a totally legit gig, and 11 people died. But at Altamont, it was the dark side of human nature. What could happen in the heart of darkness? A descent to caveman level within a few hours, thanks to Sonny Barger and his lot, the Angels, and bad red wine. It was Thunderbird and Ripple, the worst fucking rock-up wines there are, and bad acid. It was the end of the dream as far as I was concerned. There was such a thing as flower power, not that we saw much of it, but the drive for it was there. And I've no doubt that living in Haight-Ashbury from 66 to 70 and even beyond was pretty cool. Everybody got along, and it was a different way of doing things. But America was so extreme, veering between Quaker and the next minute free love, and it's still like that. And now the mood was anti-war, and basically, leave us alone. We just want to get high. When Stanley Booth and Mick went back to the hotel after we'd walked the grounds at Altamont, I stayed. It was an interesting environment. I'm not going to go back to the Sheridan and come back here tomorrow. I'm here for the duration. That's the way I felt. I've got how many hours to tune in to what's happening here? It was fascinating. You could feel it in the air that anything could happen. California being what it was pretty nice during the day. But once the sun went down, it got really cold. And then a Dante's hell began to stir. There were people, hippies, trying desperately to be nice. It was almost a desperation about love, and come on, trying to make it work, trying to make it feel right. That was where the Angels certainly didn't help. They had their own agenda, which was basically to get as out of it as possible. Hardly an organized security force. Some of those guys, their eyes are rolling, they're chewing their lips. And the deliberate provocation of parking their choppers in front of the stage. Because you can't touch an Angel's chopper, apparently. It's absolutely verboten. They put up a barrier of their Harleys and defied people to touch them. And with the crowd pressing forward, it was unavoidable. If you watch Gimme Shelter, one Angel face says it all. He's basically foaming at the mouth. He's got tattoos, the leathers and the ponytail. And he's just waiting for somebody to touch his chopper so he can go to work. They were pretty tooled up. They cut off pool sticks, and they're all carrying knives, of course, but then so was I. But whether you pull it out and use it is another thing. It's the last resort. As the evening went dark and we went on stage, the atmosphere became very lurid and hairy. As Stu said, he was there. Getting a bit hairy, Keith. I said, we've got to brass it out, Stu. Such a big crowd, we could only see in front of our immediate circle, with lights which are already in your eyes, because stage lights always are. So you're virtually half-blinded. You can't see and judge everything that's going on. You just keep your fingers crossed. Well, what can you do? The Stones are playing. What can I threaten you with? We're not playing, I said. Calm down, or we ain't gonna play no more. What's the point of traipsing your ass all the way out here and not seeing anything? But by then, certain things were set. It wasn't long after that before the shit hit the fan. In the film, you can see Meredith Hunter waving a pistol, and you can see the stabbing. He had a pale lime green suit on and a hat. He was foaming at the mouth, too. He was as nuts as the rest. To wave a shooter in front of the angels was like, well, that's what they're waiting for. That's the trigger. I doubt the thing was loaded, but he wanted to be flash. Wrong place, wrong time. When it happened, nobody knew he'd been stabbed to death. The show went on. Graham was there too. He was playing that day with the burritos. We all piled into this overloaded chopper. It was like getting back from any other gig. Thank God we got out of there, because it was hairy, though we were used to hairy escapes. This one was just on a bigger scale in a place we didn't know. But it was no hairier than getting out of the Empress Ballroom in Blackpool. In actual fact, if it hadn't been for the murder, we'd have thought it a very smooth gig, by the skin of its fucking teeth. It was also the first time Brown Sugar was played to a live audience. A baptism from hell, in a confused rumble in the Californian night. Nobody knew what had happened until we'd gotten back to the hotel later, or even the next morning. Mick Taylor being in the band on that 69 tour certainly sealed the Stones together again. So we did Sticky Fingers with him. And the music changed, almost unconsciously. You write with Mick Taylor in mind, maybe without realizing it, knowing he can come up with something different. You've got to give him something he'll really enjoy, not just the same old grind, which is what he was getting with John Mayall's Blues Breakers. So you keep looking for ways. Hopefully, turning the musicians on translates into turning the audience on. Some of the Sticky Fingers compositions were rooted in the fact that I knew Taylor was going to pull something great. By the time we got back to England, we had Sugar, we had Wild Horses, and You Gotta Move. The rest we recorded at Mix House, Stargrove's, on our new mighty mobile recording studio, and Summit Olympic Studios in March and April 1970. Can't you hear me knocking? Came out flying. I just found the tuning and the riff and started to swing it, and Charlie picked up on it just like that, and we're thinking, hey, this is some groove. So it was smiles all round. For a guitar player, it's no big deal to play. The chopping, staccato bursts of chords, very direct and spare. Marianne had a lot to do with Sister Morphine. I know Mick's writing, and he was living with Marianne at the time, and I know from the style of it there were a few Marianne lines in there. Moonlight Mile was all Mick's. As far as I can remember, Mick came in with the whole idea of that, and the band just figured out how to play it. And Mick can write. It's unbelievable how prolific he was. Sometimes you'd wonder how to turn the fucking tap off. The odd times, he would come out with so many lyrics, you're crowding the airwaves, boy. I'm not complaining. It's a beautiful thing to be able to do. It's not like writing poetry or just writing down lyrics. It's got to fit what has already been created. That's what a lyricist is. A guy that has been given a piece of music and then sets up how the vocals are going to go. And Mick is brilliant at that. Around now, we started to gather musicians to play on tracks. The so-called Super Sidemen, some of whom are still around. Nicky Hopkins had been there almost since the beginning. Ry Cooder had come and almost gone. On Sticky Fingers, we linked up again with Bobby Keys, the great Texan saxophone player, and his partner, Jim Price. We'd met Bobby very briefly, the first time since our first U.S. tour, at Elektra Studios when he was recording with Delaney and Bonnie. Jimmy Miller was working there on Let It Bleed, and called Bobby in to play a solo on Live With Me. The track was just raw, straight ahead, balls to the wall, rock and roll. Tailor-made for Bobby. A long collaboration was born. Ian Price put some horns on the end of Honky Tonk Women, but they're mixed down so low you could only hear them in the very last second and a half on the fade. Chuck Berry had a saxophone just for the very end of Roll Over Beethoven. We love that idea of another instrument coming in just for the last second. Keys and Price came over to England to play some sessions with Clapton and George Harrison, and Mick bumped into them in a nightclub. So it was get 'em while they're here. They were a hot section, and Mick felt that we needed a horn section, and it was all right with me. The Texan Bulldog gave me a look. We played before, he Texaned. We have? Where? San Antonio Team Fair. Ah, you were there? Damn fucking right. Then and there I said, screw it, and let's rock. A huge warm grin, a handshake to crush a rock. You're a motherfucker, Bobby Keys. That was the session in December 69, when Bobby blew his stuff on Brown Sugar. As much a blast for the times as anything else on the airwaves. I did a couple of clean-ups with Graham Parsons at this time, both unsuccessful. I've been through more cold turkeys than there are freezers. I took the fucking Hell Week as a matter of course. I took it as being part of what I was into. But cold turkey, once is enough, and it should be, quite honestly. At the same time, I felt totally invincible. And also, I was a bit antsy about people telling me what I could put in my body. I always felt that no matter how stoned I was, as far as I was concerned, I could cover what I was doing. And I was big-headed in that I thought I could control heroin. I thought I could take it or leave it. But it is far more seductive than you think, because you can take it or leave it for a while. But every time you try and leave it, it gets a little harder. You can't, unfortunately, decide the moment when you've got to leave it. The taking of it is easy, the leaving of it hard. And you never want to be in that position when suddenly someone bursts in and says, come with me, and you realize that you've got to leave it, and you're in no condition to go to the police station and start cold turkey. You've got to think about that and say, hey, there's one simple way of never being in that position. Don't take it. But there's probably a million different reasons you do. I think it's maybe to do with working on the stage. The high levels of energy and adrenaline require, if you can find it, a sort of antidote. And I saw smack as just becoming part of that. Why do you do it to yourself? I never particularly liked being that famous. I could face people easier on the stuff, but I could do that with booze too. It isn't really the whole answer. I also felt I was doing it not to be a pop star. There was something I didn't really like about that end of what I was doing, the blah, blah, blah. That was very difficult to handle, and I could handle it better on smack. Mick chose flattery, which is very like junk, a departure from reality. I chose junk. And also I was with my old lady, Anita, who was as avid as I was. I think we just wanted to explore that avenue. And when we did, we only meant to explore the first few blocks, but we explored it to the end. Off of Bill Burrows, I got apomorphine, along with Smitty, the vicious nurse from Cornwall. The cure that Graham Parsons and I did was total anti-heroin aversion therapy, and Smitty loved to administer it. Time, boys! There's Parsons and me in my bed. Oh no, here comes Smitty! Graham and I needed to take a cure just before the farewell tour of 1971, when he and his soon-to-be wife, Gretchen, came over to England, and we went about our usual ways. Bill Burrows recommended this hideous woman to administer the apomorphine that Burrows talked endlessly about, a therapy that was pretty useless. But Burrows swore by it. I didn't know him that well, except to talk about dope, how to get off, or how to get the quality you're after. Smitty was Burrows' favorite nurse, and she was a sadist, and the cure consisted of her shooting you up with this shit and then standing over you. You do as you're told, you don't argue. Stop sniveling, boy. You wouldn't be here if you hadn't screwed up. We took this cure in Cheyne Walk, and it was Graham and me in my four-poster bed, the only guy I ever slept with. Except that we kept falling off the bed because we were twitching so much from the treatment, with a bucket to throw up in, if you could stop twitching for enough seconds to get near it. You got the bucket, Graham? Our only outlet, if we could stand up, would be to go down and play the piano and sing for a bit, or as much as possible to kill time. I wouldn't recommend that cure to anybody. I wondered if that was Bill Burrows' joke. They sent me to probably the worst cure he'd ever had. It didn't work. It's a long 72 hours, and you've been shitting yourself and pissing yourself and twitching and spasms. And after that, your system's washed. When you take the stuff, you put all the other stuff, your endorphins, to sleep. They think, oh, he doesn't need us because something else is in there. And they take 72 hours to wake up and go back to work. But usually, as soon as you've finished, you go back on it. After all that, after a week of that shit, I need a fix. And there you go. The number of times I've cold turkeyed only to go straight back on. Because the cold turkey is so rough. The powers that be couldn't break the butterfly on the wheel. But they tried again and again at my house in Cheyne Walk in the late 60s and early 70s. I got quite used to being thrown up against my own doorposts. Coming home from a club at 3 in the morning, just as I reached my front gate, out of the bushes would leap these people with truncheons. Oh, okay, here we go again. Assume the position. Up against the wall, Keith. That fake familiarity annoyed me. They wanted to see you cringe, but I've been there, pal. Oh, it's the flying squad. We're not flying as high as you, Keith, and all that bullshit. They wouldn't have a warrant, but they were playing their own game. Oh, I've got you this time, my boy, flash old sod. Their glee in thinking they'd pin me. Oh, what have we got here, Keith? And I know I've got nothing on me. They come on heavy because they want to see if they can make a big rock and roll star quiver in his boots. You'll have to do better than that. Let's see how far you want to go. Officers walking in and out and looking at bits of paper, confused as to what's going to happen when the newspapers hear that I've been pulled in again, and wondering whether Detective Constable has made the right move tonight in his fervor to clear the world of junky guitarists. It was also a real drag to wake up every day with these blue bottles around your door, these bobbies, to wake up realizing you're a criminal. And you start to think like one. The difference between waking up in the morning and saying, oh, nice day, and peering through the curtains to see if the unmarked cars are still parked outside. Or waking up grateful that during the night there wasn't a knock at the door. What a mind-bending distraction. We're not destroying the virtue of the nation, but they think we are. So eventually, we're drawn into a war. It was Chrissy Gibbs who linked Mick up with Rupert Lowenstein when it was clear that we had to try and sever ourselves from the wiles of Alan Klein. Rupert was a merchant banker, very pooka, trustworthy, and although I didn't actually get to speak to him for about a year after he started working for us, I got on well with him from then on. He discovered I liked reading, and one book led to a library's worth over the years, sent by Rupert. Rupert didn't like rock and roll. He thought composing was